This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and here we are talking to Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin as part of our weekly Q&A with Layla, answering your questions. You can send questions to radioprogram@AOL.com. And we have quite a few questions, so let's proceed to our questions.
Yes,
we have a question about H. pylori, right?
Yes. Right. We've got an email from Jeff. Jeff writes, "Dear Dr. Hoffman, I'm 68 years old. I'm a 68-year-old man. I live in Toronto. I am your devoted listener."
Excellent.
Cool. I'm in good physical shape. I exercise 14 to 16 hours weekly, bike, cardio machines, resistance training. I used to wrestle on a competitive level when I was younger. I maintain a healthy diet. My question to you, how risky is H. pylori? Is it contagious? Why do I have a trace of this bacteria without any symptoms?
Okay, that's a really an excellent question.
And what are the natural remedies? Right.
A really excellent question. So when it comes to H. pylori, this is a bacteria that is implicated in the causation of ulcers and gastritis. I remember during the early part of my medical career when a scientist named Dr. Barry Marshall from Australia came up with what seemed like an outlandish theory, which is that ulcers, which we thought were related to just stress, you know, it's like, oh, you're stressed, you get an ulcer, that the cause of ulcers might be infectious, that you could, in effect, catch an ulcer. And so we thought it was really ridiculous. But then he did something extraordinary at a scientific conference where he was giving a lecture, and literally the audience was, you know, clicking their tongues and rolling their eyes. He stood there and he produced a test tube from his vest pocket or his jacket pocket, and he opened up the stopper and he said, "I am about to demonstrate that H. pylori is the cause of ulcers. He said, I'm going to drink from this vial. I've cultured H. pylori bacteria, and I'm going to induce an ulcer." And people were aghast as he threw his head back and swallowed the contents of the vial. And sure enough, a week or so later, he developed an ulcer. So that ushered in an era where, you know, it's kind of like thesis, antithesis, and then synthesis. You know, we start out with ideas, we reject the ideas, we poo-poo the, then all of a sudden the ideas become, oh, then maybe this is plausible. Then they become so universally accepted that we over depend on these ideas. So now, I see doctors making what I consider a rookie mistake. They screen patients for H. pylori who are fine. They just say, well, let's do a test to see if you have it. Then upon finding it, they say, well, you have H. pylori. We're going to treat it. We now have powerful antibiotics. Usually it requires three different antibiotics simultaneously along with an acid blocking medication and a pill called PrevPak. It was popular. And we eradicate the H. pylori and we say, okay, we fixed it all up for you. This is completely unnecessary because it turns out that in parts of the third world, maybe 60-70% of people have H. pylori. In this more hygiene-oriented Western world, maybe 20-30%. And by no means do 20-30% of people have ulcers. So only a very small fraction of people with H. pylori have ulcers and gastritis. Actually, one
Dr.
of the most.
Dr. Hoffman, isn't the main cause for treating the H. pylori a possible risk of gastric cancer?
Right. So there's the other thing. Then they raise the specter of cancer. And they say, well, you know, in the presence of H. pylori, you have a higher risk of cancer. But not necessarily. And there's almost an infinitesimal chance that due to the presence of H. pylori, you will develop gastric cancer. Gastric cancer, which, by the way, is a terrible cancer, but a relatively uncommon cancer in the United States. I think there may be maybe 15, 20,000 cases of it in the entire country, which I mean, seems like an awful lot. But in a population of 300 million, that's not a very high rate. So, you're right. And this is used as justification sometimes for treating it. But what happens when you treat H. pylori is that sometimes you prevent ulcers from coming back. It is effective. But you will actually increase the risk for irritable bowel syndrome lower down, and you'll increase the risk for GERD, because it turns out that the presence of H. pylori is protective against GERD. It's associated with higher risk for gastritis and ulcer, but the presence of H. pylori somewhat protects against GERD.
Which is, we see so much of it because there are more and more people showing up with GERD, and some of them, it's after they've had that triple antibiotic treatment for H. pylori.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think it's a real mistake. There are natural ways to suppress or eliminate H. pylori. Cranberry extract, mastic gum, omega-3 fatty acids, probiotics among them, and there are several others.
I think endothelin would also be helpful.
EGCG seems to have an anti-H. pylori effect. And so, there's some ways to go without using the antibiotics.
Yeah. Because sometimes, and I've seen a couple of severe cases where the patient, after the treatment for H. pylori, they're hoarse. They're chronically hoarse. They can't get rid of that gurgle.
That would be silent reflux. So my advice to this guy, bottom line, is just leave it alone. And, the other question is it contagious? And they actually did a study on this. And the reason they know that it's contagious is because there are sub-strains of H. pylori. In other words, two people with H. pylori may have different types of H. pylori, or subtypes of H. pylori. But what they found was that in married couples who presumably have oral contact, kissing, that there was a high concordance of the same subspecies of H. pylori between the partners. So they acquired it likely through oral contact. However, there wasn't 100% transference of the H. pylori from one partner to the other, which means that either it's not always transferred through oral contact, or else these people weren't really kissing very much. I don't know which was the case.
That could be right.
I mean, you could be married and you could really, you could actually not have, deep kissing for years and years.
I suppose. Wow. All right. So, Jeff, the reason Jeff is writing us is his doctor prescribed that pack of the triple antibiotic therapy, but
rookie mistake.
He's not taking it yet.
It's a rookie mistake.
Yeah.
Don't do it.
He's not taking it yet because he has absolutely no symptoms.
That's right.
Yeah.
To me is bad medicine. Really bad medicine. I'm seldom going on this radio program or this podcast, either on my radio program, which is live, or on the podcasts. I'm seldom going to contravene medical advice, tell people, don't do what the doctor said. But I got to say, in this instance, it just doesn't make any sense at all,
But we still see this here with patients who come in, which is interesting. I had H. pylori. Symptoms, no anything.
I would bet you, if, and I can do a little research on this, maybe you can too, we can come back next week and report on this. I bet you that the guidelines from the people who make the drug and from the medical society, probably the American Gastroenterological Society, now say that you should only treat H. pylori if it's implicated in an ulcer or gastritis, and that you shouldn't treat it routinely. I bet you anything that doctor is following a kind of an old therapeutic fad, which is, find a bug, use a drug.
Right, and this is a doctor in Toronto. So
government medicine.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, Jeff, we wish you the best of luck. Okay. We've got an email from Edward. Dr. Hoffman, I have enjoyed listening to your program for many years. I would like to know if you have any solutions to restore my loss of taste and smell, which has been for several years now.
Mm-hmm.
I had a visit with my otolaryngologist.
ENT, right?
Did I say that right?
Ear, nose, and throat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he examined my sinuses, didn't find any problems.
Okay.
Now, a little bit of history he sent us here, which, Dr. Hoffman, you may find helpful. In 2008, Edward had endoscopic sinus surgery.
Okay.
In 2009, he had 6 chemo treatments for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And
Bingo.
2009 to 2011, he received Rituxan every 2 months.
Bingo. Okay, so there we go.
Once a month, here's the last thing. Once a month, I receive an IV of gamma globulin.
Okay, so
for my compromised immune system.
Okay, so here's the deal. I mean, this often smell and taste loss is idiopathic. We don't know why it occurs. By the way, there's some association, but not always, between loss of olfactory sense, true smell loss, not taste loss, because taste is often based on the taste buds, but is also associated with the olfactory nerves in the nasal passages, associated with a higher risk of Alzheimer's and dementia. So it may be one of the first signs that one is moving towards Alzheimer's disease, although not always the case. So that's alarming to some people. They're definitely going to go downhill with mental function, but not necessarily the case. People have chronic sinus problems, sinus surgery. That's a setup for loss of smell. People who had chemotherapy damages the nerves. It can cause permanent loss of, or at the very least temporarily affects taste. Can affect the taste buds, can certainly affect the olfactory nerves. And then there's some immunological therapy. So we got Rituxan, that's a monoclonal antibody. And that too can create some changes to the immune system, and maybe there's some autoimmune stuff going on. And he's got a lot of potential risk factors for autoimmune destruction of the olfactory nerve, or chemo destruction of the nerve, and also just the chronic inflammation or infection can damage the nerve, and then surgical instrumentation from the sinus surgery.
Yeah.
So, this is a complicated case, and, you know, is there a way to restore it? There's some suggestion that the nutrient phosphatidylcholine can help. I've seen that reported, but it doesn't always work, only in the minority of cases. Alpha-lipoic acid.
Zinc, Dr. Hoffman?
Zinc is something that seems to be more associated with zinc deficiencies associated with loss of taste, rather than taste being taste buds. Rather than the olfactory nerve. Alpha-lipoic acid, helpful for some neuropathies, and, you know, may play a role there. But it's a tough kind of problem, especially with all these risk factors for damage to the olfactory nerve.
Right. Yeah. And the biggest complaint of loss of taste and smell is you don't enjoy your food.
Don't enjoy your food, and sometimes what it also does is you get the only foods that you like are really sweet, because that sweet taste seems to penetrate, and you only have an appreciation for the texture of high calorie, fatty or sweet foods that where it's so overly sweetened that it passes the threshold of sensation, and that's bad for you, because you don't appreciate healthy foods.
Right. And in addition to that, cancer loves sugar, and having those sweets. Yeah, that's interesting that sometimes they'll retain their ability to taste sweet, because I believe those taste buds are in the front, towards the tip of the tongue.
I'm just saying that it's sort of like when you have hearing loss, you may maintain you have high frequency loss, you have low frequency loss, that kind of thing. You know.
Wow. Oh, Edward, best of luck to you. And we hope you continue to remain well. with your treatments. Wow. Okay. We've got an email from Betty. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you both for doing a great job. My question is, I am on Carvedilol and Norvasc.
Okay.
I have gained 15 pounds in 6 months taking these medicines. My doctor doesn't seem to care.
Does she say what condition? Does she say what condition it's for?
For hypertension.
Right. Okay, so those are a beta blocker and a calcium channel blocker.
Yeah. Betty says, I go to the gym 3 days a week. I watch my diet. I'm 62 years old, 5'3", and 148 pounds.
That's a little too much.
Yeah. What can I do to lose weight? I gained the weight around my belly.
Well, you know, we would have to kind of do an analysis of the situation.
Her diet. I would still question her diet. I would take a look there to see if there are any insulin triggers. We would address all that first.
What
right?
did she say? She says, I eat a good diet, whatever?
Yeah, Something
like
she
that.
Says, you know,
healthy.
She watches her diet.
Watch, you know. It's like I watch my waistline, but it's like 42 inches. You know, I watch it. It's right under my nose. You know, I can't see my feet. You know, I watch my waistline.
Oh, look, I can't see my feet. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, I'm not trying to make fun of this person, but, typically we will have patients who come in and say, I eat a very healthy diet. Well, what does that consist of? The diet may consist of, you know,
a
healthy.
Whole wheat only.
I have whole wheat bagels, or I have a healthy granola bar for breakfast. I'll have a healthy breakfast shake, you know, which may be a Trojan horse for sugar.
I make a smoothie with lots of fruit in it.
Yeah. You know, it's healthy. It's healthy. And, I only have whole grain, use whole grain sandwich bread. It's organic.
I only use honey. I don't use sugar.
Yeah. Right. What's that popular, cactus thing now that's like the sweetener?
I only use agave.
Agave syrup. I don't use white sugar. I use agave syrup.
Which is the new high fructose corn syrup, little
right.
do they know.
Yeah, I don't drink soda. I drink juice, natural juice.
I only drink 100% juice.
Right, 100% juice. It's
I
not
only
even,
drink diet soda.
It's unsweetened. The juice is unsweetened.
Diet soda.
The juice is unsweetened. There's no added sugar. And so on and so on
skim
it goes.
Milk.
Right.
Skim milk.
Yeah.
Only.
Exactly.
I only
low fat this, low fat that.
Fat.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I have low fat yogurt. I have low fat.
Right.
You know, that's to me
right.
is we hear a lot of, and I'm not making fun of these people because it's very hard to become an expert in this field and to you'd be able to be wary of the pitfalls. So that's number one. Part of the problem is that she's on medications that tend to thwart weight loss. So you get in a vicious cycle. You have high blood pressure and they want to treat it. They put you on medications that make it harder to lose weight. So your blood pressure is handled, but your weight remains high. You because your weight's high, you're lethargic, you can't exercise as much. So even though we're dealing with one risk factor for heart attack and stroke, we still have other risk factors, such as that your blood sugar may go up and, you're overweight, and your lipids may be high.
And that can cause heart attack and stroke, too.
Right. So, what we sometimes do is we'll say, look, you're on a medication that is going to hamper your weight loss. So we'd like you to try, a very, very concerted program of diet while we taper your medication, get you off the medication that's impairing your weight loss. And sometimes we're successful. We're able to wean people off of medication, the medication that's in their way preventing weight loss. Many people are hypothyroid. Doctors won't recognize it because it's borderline. We might have to treat that as well. The variety of factors there, but it's requires a little bit of analysis to break through.
It needs a diet review, and I'm going to just, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to be a little presumptuous here.
Yeah.
This is a 62-year-old woman.
Yeah.
And using the language, I watch my diet, that to me smells of calories.
Okay, yeah.
And calories only, and of course the low fat.
Yeah.
The low fat diet, which has prevailed probably in her life.
Mm-hmm.
And even in my life going back a couple of decades, so. This warrants a complete diet review.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it just sounds like another day at the office for us here.
It does.
It's a busman's holiday for
Betty,
you and me.
Betty, you should come see us. Yeah.
Right. Or at the very least, you know, have a, try a, even a phone consultation with, Layla. You know, sharing your medical records and, you know, such that you can really delve into it. Okay. We have time for a quick question. Is there such a question?
Yeah. Well, let's see if this is quick. This is from Henry. Do you follow or agree with the writings of Dr. David Perlmutter and Dr. William Davis in regard to the central role of inflammation in autoimmunity and the toxic nature of wheat and sugar? Yes, is the answer.
Yes, and I mean, I'm going to qualify that because I think that there's some people who do okay. But I got to say that, hey, having experimented on myself, and I'm not someone who has celiac disease. I do have allergies, and I'm better off not having wheat, but I don't develop, you know, severe autoimmunity and inflammation on wheat. But I've noticed that, now that I'm on a paleo diet, eliminating wheat and all grains, yeah, I'm doing the Whole 30 diet, is I just feel fantastic. I mean, I'm really free of, you know, muscle aches and pains. My recovery time from exercise is, you know, very quick turnaround. Incidentally, I'm eating like a house on fire and I lost 10 pounds. So, you know.
That's everybody's wish.
Yeah. I mean, it's like eat your cake and have it. I'm not eating cake.
The new dessert is fruit.
Right. I'm actually not on a low-carb diet. A lot of people think that paleo is very low-carb. It isn't low-carb because I'm having fruit.
There's sweet potatoes, and there's fruit, and there's squash, and bananas, and pineapple. It's all good because it's all whole, natural, unprocessed food, the way we are meant to eat.
So let's speak to Perlmutter's thesis, because Perlmutter's thesis is that, you know, he's a neurologist, and he's concerned about the brain and neurological disorders. There's a lot to be said for a ketogenic diet, which is goes beyond just a gluten-free diet. It's a very low-carb diet where fat is the fuel for your brain. And I think that there's emerging scientific evidence that that's helpful. We just saw a patient with dementia yesterday, was it?
Yesterday.
And our recommendation is that he move towards a ketogenic diet, have a lot of coconut oil as a medium chain triglyceride. It's a brain fuel. It's a brain fuel. So,
And what's useful about the coconut oil is because it's a medium chain triglyceride, it demands to be metabolized immediately by the liver, putting you in a fat burning metabolism immediately. That is its benefit.
Okay.
Medium chain triglycerides like coconut oil.
And, you know, that may be one of the reasons why I'm losing weight more rapidly, because I routinely use a lot of coconut oil. I use it in my cooking, and I also make sure that I have literally coconut cream on some berries at night. So I'm going through can after can of coconut cream, not the sweetened kind, because not the kind that you make a pina colada out of, you know.
Right. The unflavored. But I've had a few clients tell me, when I take coconut oil, I am energetic and revved, and that's exactly what it provides. And it's such a healthy, healthy fat. Antiviral, antimicrobial, all of that.
Yeah.
Helps with the immune system.
So, you know, in a sense, we do agree with William Davis. I think there's some people who can achieve optimal health while consuming wheat. You know, that may be okay for them.
Yeah. Yeah. And William Davis, Dr. William Davis is author of The Wheat Belly.
Yes.
And Wheat Belly Diet.
But he's not a one-trick pony. You know, he's actually, when I've talked to him, I thought he was going to be coming up with something really simplistic. Wheat Belly is just sort of a way to market his philosophy. He's about eating a grain-free diet, moving more towards paleo, and he really knows his science. So he is really worth reading and listening to. We've done several podcasts with him, as well as with Dr. Perlmutter. So I always enjoy talking to these really smart folks who've done the research that substantiates, what seem like kind of, irrational fads. There really is a scientific basis for, at the very least undertaking a trial of this. I think for some people it's a matter of, you know, try it. You might like it. You know, if you experience it and it's beneficial, then it's for you. It's not, you know, a lot of people just, they resist it because there's no buy-in. It doesn't sound appealing. But
yes,
the best
they don't
way
to give up their bread, yeah, or their pasta.
No. I didn't particularly want to do that, but you know, I just said, well, I got to give it a try. You know, I talk about it so much. I tell some patients to go on it. I'm kind of a hypocrite if I don't explore it myself. And I just got to do it for 30 days, and I'm hooked on the feeling. I just really am enjoying it.
You know, I do have to mention, just as an aside, that I've seen a sandwich shop around our work neighborhood here near 23rd Street called Hot Belly.
Huh.
And it's specifically a sandwich shop.
Huh.
And I said, well, that's apropos.
Well, maybe you can
do... You're going to eat sandwiches.
Maybe you can take...
Hot Belly is a good name. Okay.
Take a picture with your iPhone, and then we can post it at drhoffman.com.
Yeah.
Pot
so there
belly.
Was our quick question, Dr. Hoffman.
Wow.
From Henry.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we kind of elaborated on it. All right. Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us, folks. And a reminder, these podcasts are free. We love getting them out to you. One of the ways that you can help to assure their continuity and, to some extent, underwrite their costs is via participation at the Hoffman Center store, hoffmancenter.com or drhoffman.com. Click on the store. Browse the product selection there. We highly curate products of excellence there and offer them at economical prices, not just to our patients. It's chiefly for our patients, but also for our listeners. So check it out and thereby assure continuous flow of information as well as supporting your health. Thanks, Layla, for joining us.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.